This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
We'll do some global trade today, a little bit of virtual reality as well. Also, Batman in Lego form. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, February the 9th. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. There is going to be some mixing of work with slightly less work this weekend for President Trump. He meets Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at the White House tomorrow, followed by a bilateral weekend getaway down at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Golf, apparently, with some global trade on the side, because with the Trans-Pacific Partnership a distant memory, there are no small number of questions about the future of trade between the U.S. and Japan. Tokyo is the number three economy in the world. It is America's fourth largest trading partner. We swapped nearly $200 billion worth of stuff last year. So Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going from New York with where things stand on that and what might be ahead.
The two countries traded before TPP and will continue to trade now that it's dead.
The United States backing away from TPP should have negligible effects on the short term of the trade between the United States and Japan.
Robert Eberhardt tracks Japanese industry as a management professor at Santa Clara University.
Now, the reason is all the agreements that have governed our trading relationships since the 70s remain in place, particularly the overall agreements under WTO.
But many powerful American industries would like to see the situation change.
U.S. producers, agricultural producers, are very interested in the Japanese market.
Sheila Smith is Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Whether it's the pork industry or whether it's some of the grain industries, there's a lot to be gained for our agricultural producers.
The TPP would have slashed tariffs for American farmers selling in Japan, but now it's back to the drawing board. Jim Schoaf is Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says it can be harder to cut a deal when there are only two countries at the table.
It becomes very zero-sum, and in many ways, TPP benefited from the fact that there were multiple players, and we could get concessions from Vietnam and Australia and others that kind of offset each of our interests in the process.
So if America wants a better deal for its farmers, Japan may demand a better deal for its truck makers. Matthew Goodman worked on Asia in the Obama administration and is now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I think it's going to reopen all the so-called old issues of market access for U.S. agricultural products in Japan and trade in automobiles in particular.
This is an important relationship for both sides with tough talks ahead. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
All right, here's a question. You run a big health insurance company. You know, because capitalism, that you got to grow or die. You make a $48 billion deal to buy a rival, and then a federal judge says, yeah, no, that would be anti-competitive. Such is the lot of Anthem, whose proposed purchase of Cigna was torpedoed yesterday. Same basic thing has happened to an anticipated deal between Aetna and Humana. So, to get to the question that I promised, with the future of the healthcare economy uncertain at best, now what for four of this country's five biggest health insurance companies? From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that one.
Imagine being a kid in the toy store and your mom just told you you can't have that 7-foot-tall giant panda. That's one way to think about how Anthem feels about the blocked merger. Now, says Andy Slavitt, former senior executive at UnitedHealth, it's time to move on.
I'm sure all of them have a plan B that they've been working with their board on. And the one thing that's hard to do as a public company is not to grow.
With all their billions, Anthem and the rest have Plan B, Plan C, and Plan D. They could buy back shares. They could buy up smaller insurers. Companies could even roll the dice, hope the Trump administration is more open, and try different blockbuster deals. And then there's this.
What I think we'll see more of is partnerships.
Harvard Business School economist Limor Daphne expects insurers to either team up or outright buy doctors and hospitals.
Try to both keep people healthy and ensure that, you know, their journey through the healthcare system is optimized. That sounds hard, and it is hard.
If insurers can better manage costs and improve health, they'll definitely grow. But for now, insurance analyst Robert Leshefsky with Health Policy and Strategy Associates predicts they'll keep window shopping.
So I don't think these companies can make any bold moves until we clear the air on just exactly what's going to happen to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare.
Unfortunately for these companies, that may mean staring longingly up at that giant panda, waiting for another day. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Now some news from Milan. Not fashion, but oil. Italian prosecutors are seeking a criminal trial against Royal Dutch Shell, as well as the CEO of Italy's main oil company, Eni, it's called. The question at issue is whether they bribed Nigerian officials to get access to oil fields in that country with a load of money that the Nigerian people never saw. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
The case focuses on a deal in 2011. The Italian oil company Eni and Royal Dutch Shell acquired offshore real estate in Nigeria to drill for oil. Prosecutors have lots of leaked documents, for instance, detailing oilmen schmoozing with Nigeria's ex-oil minister. Barnaby Pace is with Global Witness, an anti-corruption group.
We've got records of their internal emails describing how they're having lunch and nice champagne with him and negotiating directly over how much they should pay him in exchange for this oil license.
The oil companies say they paid $1.1 billion to the government, though investigators say it went to shell companies, i.e. bribes. These aren't new questions for Nigeria, where whopping amounts of oil money have disappeared, says Natasha Ezro at the University of Sussex in England.
Whatever's going on is kind of murky, but all of a sudden the Nigerian petroleum company found they couldn't pay $16 billion to the government and owed revenue. They didn't know what had happened to it.
Costantino Grasso teaches financial crime at the University of East London. He says the problem is entrenched. Oil is so valuable to governments and their energy companies worldwide.
Corruption in the energy sector is wildly rampant. This is a fact. Government companies, they would like to conclude contracts at any cost, even secretly bribing foreign public officials.
Officials pocket the cash and the people never see it. It's a piece of what many scholars call the resource curse. Lots of countries rich in oil are actually very poor. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
In a meeting at the White House today with a bunch of airline CEOs, President Trump said he is working on a, quote, phenomenal tax plan. No details were forthcoming, but traders took that and ran with it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a report on Business Insider this week saying Best Buy is going to close more than half of the virtual reality demo stations it's got set up inside its stores, about 200 in all. Best Buy says the changes are seasonal, but we thought there might be more to it. So we got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So I thought VR was the hot new thing, man. What the what?
There is always a hot new thing, isn't there?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Look, it could be as simple, and I have said this a million times, as not wanting to go into a store and put something on your face that has been on a bunch of other people's faces.
Yep.
This could just be the pink eye factor in terms of people not wanting to try on Oculus headsets at Best Buy, and that's not for nothing. There could be a lot of people, a reason that people aren't interested in demos. They maybe think it's going to take too long. With Oculus in particular, it's very likely it's the price, right? Nobody really wants to get sucked into a really compelling demo of something that costs $600 minimum. The Samsung Gear VR unit seems to be the runaway winner. They shipped, according to one report, of 4.5 million of them last year. Oof. But I should note here that they were handing them out with the purchase of new smartphones. So I would ask how many of those are actually being used. It's just still really early, even though it feels like it's not.
Well, let me get you then to that adoption question, because, you know, I've done a couple of demos with these things, and I've actually been sitting in other rooms with people with them on. And it's just weird, and it's isolating, and it's you think people are looking at you. Is it possible that VR is just ahead of its time, that we haven't figured out the, I guess, it's the interface thing yet?
Yeah. In fact, I think that's absolutely the case. It's sort of ironic because VR has actually been around since, for, you know, 75 years or more. The Sensorama was introduced in 1960. Wow. It's kind of just always been ahead of its time. And it's still a hard sell, like you said. It's isolating. You have to sort of sit by yourself or rearrange your entire man cave around this virtual reality setup, you know. There's limited content. The tech isn't perfect. It makes people nauseous. I mean, there are a lot of really significant barriers to adoption. And then on top of that, when we have so many sources of entertainment in our lives, I think people are still trying to come up with a reason why they need it.
Yeah, and there's other stuff in that category too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a ton of technology in that category and always has been. And I think you could look around the tech market and say wearables are actually, despite all of the hype, in a really similar position as virtual reality. You couldn't come up with a reason other than tracking your activity, which everybody does for 3 months. Then they stop. Then they gain 10 pounds. Then they start doing it again. You know, it's a cycle, but it's not a cycle that says, I desperately have to have this. I don't see people wearing the Apple Watch around, you know. But it's not just that. The Internet of Things has been way slower to take off than people thought. And I mark my words, that is a category that's going to take much longer than people expected.
I will say, we have an Alexa, and other than using it to play music, it's my daughter's favorite Alexa, tell me a joke toy. That's it. That's what it's for.
Yeah.
Right?
It's basic. The Amazon Echo is basically for kids and setting timers for kids.
That's and, exactly right.
And the research bears that out. People stop using it after a couple of months. So if necessity is the mother of invention, I think the tech industry thinks that invention is the mother of invention. Right. We will make it and you will buy it.
Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
I should have said while we had her on the phone that the latest episode of our new podcast, it's called Make Me Smart, is at its conversation with me and Molly and Tim Wu from Columbia Law about the Federal Communications Commission and net neutrality. Bunch of good stuff. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. You know how we've been saying for like months now how Brexit is a threat to the future of the European Union? Yeah, well, and yet another lesson that it's the problem you thought you had solved that always comes back to bite you. The Greek debt crisis has made a most unwelcome reappearance. Stephen Beard has the story from the European desk in London.
The IMF reignited the crisis with one word, explosive. That's how it described Greece's debt problem. The fund has a point, says Stephen Clapham of Phoenician Capital Management.
Greece hasn't been able to sort itself out. It hasn't taken any of the reforms that it really needs. And the IMF has decided, well, we're not going to give Greece any more money unless it starts to sort its act out.
Greece owes $350 billion, more than 180% of GDP. The fund says it's unrepayable. There's got to be more debt relief. But the main creditor, the German government, faces re-election later this year. And so, says Carsten Hess of the German bank Berenberg, debt relief is not in the cards.
Germany or the German politicians have promised to the taxpayer, to the voter, that Greece will pay back its debt. They didn't say when, but they said they will pay it back.
President Trump's pick as the next US ambassador to the EU, Ted Malik, has stirred the pot. He told Bloomberg News that Greece should and probably will pull out of the single currency.
There is probably, from an economist's perspective, a very strong reason for Greece moving away from the euro.
Crunch time for the Greeks comes this July when they'll need a cash injection of some $7.5 billion. In spite of the IMF jitters, they'll probably get it. The EU has too many other crises to want to see real turmoil in Greece. The words road, kick and can spring to mind. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, I knew we tested the movie, and it tested well, but it wasn't testing like the cultural phenomenon that it became.
Rolling the dice on movie Legos. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 118 points today, 0.6%, almost 20,172. The NASDAQ up 32 points, about 0.6% as well, 5715. The S&P 500 delivered 13 points to the good, another 0.6%, 2307. As we mentioned, a judge has blocked the proposed merger between Anthem and Cigna on antitrust grounds. Anthem up nearly 2% today. Cigna added 0.2%. The other two companies that had their merger plans nixed recently, Aetna essentially flat today. Humana weighed in with a gain of 3.7%. President Trump met with executives from some of the country's biggest airlines, as I mentioned. Delta up 2.5% today. Southwest up 3%. JetBlue up 3.5%. Bonds down. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.39%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We did some reporting up in Washington State last fall, looking at how the farms of the Yakima Valley and the high-tech startups of Seattle on the other side of the Cascades have at least one big thing in common. Immigrant labor, albeit with varying skill sets. One of the stops that we made was a company called Remitly. It's an app-based service that helps immigrants here send money back home, remittances. We talked to Lazaro Carrion when we were there. He's a marketing manager at Remitly, and he was, at the time, a brand new American. Lazaro, it's good to talk to you again.
Likewise, how you doing?
I'm well. Last time we spoke, it was, what, September-ish, before the election. You were a relatively new citizen at the time. And you were excited, man. That's the only word I can think of. How you feeling now?
No, absolutely. Definitely still excited. You know, a lot has changed ever since then, but, if I could paint the picture for you, it feels like I got invited to a party, and the moment I get there, everyone's acting like it's a funeral, looking around, you know, my environment, people are bummed, but you know, I'm still holding that optimism, and I'm excited to, you know, celebrate what it means to be a citizen, and you know, staying engaged, trying to understand what's going on. But there's a lot out there to read and really digest. So
yeah.
When
you talk to your family and your relatives back in Mexico, what's the sense you get from them?
Yeah, they're wondering how in the world did our president get elected, but at the same time, I remind them. You know, how did your president get elected? You know, there's a lot of parallels between both presidents, and, you know, they're not an accurate representation of the people at times. And so they do tell me that, you know, he's crazy. Why is he wanting to build a wall? And, you know, why is he want to impose a tax? And So their response is typically, you know, confusion, but at the same time, I've seen some solidarity across not just my family members, but the Mexican people in general. And I think this is a good thing, in my opinion, but to focus their energy and their attention on what can they do down there, as opposed to project hate or project whatever negative emotion may result from it.
Lazaro, thanks very much.
Absolutely.
We talked to Lazaro's boss while we were up in Seattle, too. Matt Oppenheimer is a co-founder and the CEO of Remitly. Matt, it's good to talk to you again.
Kai, good to speak with you as well.
So here you are. You're a guy who runs a business founded on, in essence, immigration policy. You've got a new reality you're dealing with. What's that mean to you?
Yeah, you know, I think that the reality is there's 40 million immigrants in the U.S. Our service helps people send money back home, and, you know, we'll continue to work hard as ever to serve those customers.
I'm assuming you travel a good deal as part of your job. Have you been overseas since the inauguration?
I have not been overseas since the inauguration, but you're right. I do travel quite a bit overseas.
All right. The root of the question is, what are your folks overseas telling you about how they're seeing it from outside this country?
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a lot of fear and concern with folks that are traveling. And I think that the important thing is that fear and concern has been there for a long time. It might be accentuated now, but I think a lot of immigrants, especially who go through, you know, customs, it's an uncomfortable process. And I think, unfortunately, some of the recent actions have only, you know, kind of stoked that fear and concern. But the fundamental problem with our immigration system has been there for a long time.
Do you, over the next 4 years or perhaps eight of the Trump administration, what's your forward guidance, as they like to see on Wall Street, for your business?
Yeah, you know, I think that in some ways it makes what we do more important than ever. People send money back to their loved ones to connect with them. And I think that, you know, we will be more active than ever to serve our customers and make sure that we're there for them.
Matt Oppenheimer, he's the co-founder and CEO of Remitly up in Seattle. We talked to him in September for a bunch of stories we did then. Matt, thanks very much.
Thanks, Guy.
There are three big movies coming out this weekend, all of them sequels or otherwise parts of a franchise. 50 Shades Darker, John Wick 2 with Keanu Reeves, and the Lego Batman movie. The second in what we can now safely call the Lego movie franchise, because there are more coming. Dan Lin is the producer of that franchise. He's also the CEO of Lin Pictures, the production company behind it. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Kai.
Tell me where you came up with the idea for the Lego movie, what is now becoming a franchise, I guess?
I came up with it, honestly, just watching my son play. And my son Miles was five at the time.
Said every dad ever, right? I mean, you know, right?
My home is a incubator for ideas. But I watched him play, and he was playing with his Lego, and I studied what he was doing. He was actually talking to himself. At first, I thought he was maybe mumbling, but then I realized that as I got closer that he was telling himself a story as he built these Lego creations. Huh. And so as I listened more to his story, I realized that he was telling this amazing story in his own mind, that there's this adventure going on while he physically played with these Lego bricks. And so I thought to myself, if I can capture that imagination, that creativity that's going on in his brain and kind of personify it into a movie, that would be a movie I'd really want to see.
The thing that gets me about this story, but a lot of movie development stories, is that this was back in like 2008, 2009 when you had the first idea, and the movie doesn't drop till 2014. So it was a long time this franchise was in the making.
Painfully long, Kai. I mean, it was one of those things that I had to start by convincing people that this is a good idea, starting with the Lego company, who were hesitant at the time. Their sales were through the roof every year in a down economy. You know, remember 2008, 2009, that was a bad time in America as far as the economy. And still their sales were up 25% a year. And so the big risk for them is, why make a Lego movie? Because I was not asking them to make a Ninjago movie or a Bionicle movie, meaning a movie based on one of their toy brands. Right. I was actually asking for the mothership. You know, it's a Lego movie. So there was no room for error, because if this movie didn't work, it was going to hurt their main brand.
That's a big ask. Was it a series of repeated asks over the years, or did you go in and have one pitch meeting and they were like, oh yeah, we're on board?
I wish it were that easy. I did have one pitch meeting in Denmark that I'll remember for the rest of my life, where we gave the pitch, and I was with the Hegeman brothers, who were the original writers who wrote the treatment for the movie. And we did pitch the two acts and the third act reveal that we ultimately showed in the movie, the father-son story. And I got to say, I still remember it. The executives in the room at the end of the pitch, they actually stood up and clapped. So I knew we're at a great way to start. But that was only the beginning. You know, certainly they have approvals all the way. And there are times when we struggled with the movie, and they really hung in there with us. Yeah. And famously, we had a whole version of the first movie that we put up in storyboards and black and white drawings, and we put it up, and the movie didn't work. And we shut that version down and started again. And that was 2 years in the process. So it was pretty scary.
Did you have a sense when you were finally done and you had the final print and colorized or whatever the movie language is, did you have a sense of how big it was going to be? I mean, it did like $500 million or something.
Yeah, no, I had no idea. What we did know is that we put our hearts and souls into the movie, so it felt like a very personal movie. And we walked away going, you know what? No idea if this is going to catch on, but we made the movie we want to make. And if people enjoy it, that's going to be the ultimate win. But certainly we had no idea it was going to become the phenomenon that it did.
Okay, so no pressure here, but now you've got Lego Batman. You feeling a little tense?
I was. You know, honestly, I haven't slept probably in 2 weeks. But now that reviews are coming in and people responding to the movie, I'm able to sleep a little bit better. But yeah, the pressure is absolutely intense. Suddenly, Warner Brothers deemed us one of their three big tentpoles that will boost their company. So there's the Lego movies, there's a Harry Potter franchise through Fantastic Beasts, and there's the DC movies. And so
that's good company, man. You kidding me?
It is, but it's scary because that's the stuff that, you know, Wall Street's talking about. Those are things that when you make a movie good, it'll help boost the stock. If you don't, you know, it's a major loss. So for us, you know, the pressure is certainly on.
Dan Lin is the CEO of Lin Pictures. Lego Batman is coming out this weekend. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
We've had some fun with superheroes, too. You know, we did a whole episode of Marketplace set in a world where superheroes are real. Check it out. Our superhero show is at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, brought to you by Title V of the Code of Federal Regulations, Section 2635.702, Use of Public Office for Private Gain.
Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell. I'm going to go get some on myself today.
Senior White House staffer Kellyanne Conway this morning on Fox News chatting about the Nordstrom Ivanka Trump President Trump tweet of yesterday. The rule says, in relevant part, that government employees, quote, shall not use his public office for his own private gain for the endorsement of any product, service, or enterprise, end of quote.
This is just, it's a wonderful line. I own some of it. I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today, everybody. You can find it online.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said at his briefing this afternoon that Conway has been counseled about her remarks. Nordstrom shares, by the way, up more than 6% since Ivanka's father accused the company of treating her badly. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 118 points today, 0.6% almost. The NASDAQ up 32 points, also 0.6%. S&P 513 points to the good, another 0.6%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.